There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings you the best bits of today's show from Thursday, December the 12th. We've got tips on beating the crowds at Dubai International Airport on one of the busiest weekends of the year.
Our producer, Mohammed Suleiman, has put together this special report.
Preview. Your attention, please.
To say it's going to be busy at Dubai's airports this weekend would be a massive understatement. Dubai Airport says DXB, which is the world's busiest international airport, could welcome more than 1 million passengers between today and Sunday. Meanwhile, Emirates Airline is expecting close to 730,000 passengers to depart and arrive in the city on their festive holidays from today until the end of the month. They say 300,000 will fly out of Dubai over the next 8 days, with the busiest time for departures from Terminal 3 predicted to be tomorrow. Speaking to the agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8 earlier this week, Eugene Berry, Executive Vice President Commercial at Dubai Airports, said passengers can take steps to make sure they're on time.
This weekend is very busy, so the holiday season is starting early for Dubai residents. So we would urge people to come earlier than you normally plan to come to the airport. You know, check in online, download apps, plan your journey. There are many different ways of coming to the airport these days. And we want people to travel calmly through the airport and have a stress-free journey with us and stay with us. And in the meantime, enjoy and spend a happy time with us and start their journey well and start the holidays well.
Authorities also say they're working closely with airlines and other service partners to ensure that there's a smooth flow of traffic over the early festive season. So if you are traveling this week, do make sure you're at the airport extra early. That includes you too, Richard Dean.
Final call for Richard Dean and family. Please report to Gate 7 immediately.
This is Mohammed Suleiman reporting for the Business Breakfast. Thank you.
I didn't know he'd done that. That's the first time we've heard it.
It was brilliant.
That was brilliant, Mohammed.
I'm not quite sure how he did that, but yes.
It's fabulous. We heard the guys from Dubai Airport there saying, you've got to get there early, avoid the queues. I don't believe any of this. This is a Colm McLaughlin conspiracy that he's been spinning for 30 years, the head of Dubai Duty Free. Any opportunity he gets, he says, you've got to get to Dubai Airport early. It's going to be really busy. It's not going to be busy. It's one of the world's biggest, most efficient airports. It's all electronic and it's all biometric now. It takes like 10 minutes to check in and go through security. He just wants us to buy more stuff.
That ruins me, though, for other airports, because I always know I can cut it a bit fine here and pretty much walk through, right?
Yes.
You might have a little bit of a wait when you've got to stick your stuff in the plastic bins and put them through the X-ray machine. But generally, you're just walking straight through.
Yeah.
I use, unfortunately, that same, approach to other airports, and I have nearly been caught out more than once.
Oh, they're not Dubai, are they?
Because you just get used to being like, she'll be fine.
It'll be fine, and you do get it, and it's literally a 45-minute wait to go through security or passport control.
I've nearly missed a plane in Chicago and have nearly missed a plane back out of Florida.
Yeah.
Because of that reason. Taking my Dubai attitude with me.
We do kind of take it for granted. Look, I mean, it does have, let's not sugarcoat it, it does have sometimes queues at busy times. Getting a taxi can sometimes be a bit of a faff. We're not saying it's perfect, but it is, for the world's busiest international airport, it's pretty smooth, isn't it? I've never, ever, and how often do we use it? I mean, 10, 15 times a year. But we don't work for McKinsey, we're not on a plane every week, but we use it quite a lot. I don't think I've ever worried about missing a plane leaving Dubai.
Having said that, there are some gates that are a longer walk than you realise.
This is true.
So, because I've had to do a bit of a, I've done a sprint before once in the airport. So nothing to do with getting through security, getting through immigration, getting through anything else. But once I was in there, happily meandering, taking my own sweet time in Colm's duty free, and have suddenly thought, I should go to the gate, and then suddenly realised that the gate was nowhere near me.
So there you go. You can believe us if you like, or you can believe Dubai airports. But if you are travelling today, look, why not get there earlier? It's a lovely airport. You can spend.
The F&B offerings are much improved.
They are very, very good, aren't they? Talking of Colm McLaughlin, we saw him yesterday, didn't we?
We did. We had our memorial service in Oud Meta for Malcolm Taylor. And it was beautiful. Colm spoke.
He did.
Very, very touchingly. A number of Malcolm's family and loved ones spoke. But I think that the... I was about to say the stage was absolutely stolen, and I don't mean stage at all. But the moment that I think had everyone crying who wasn't already crying was the moment when listeners began to get up and speak.
Yeah.
People we'd never met, who had never met Malcolm, who just got up to say, look, I just need to say he was a part of my day every day, had been for 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. I had coffee with him every morning. I packed my kids' lunches listening to him. And that pretty much undid all of us.
Yeah, it did. But thank you so much to all of you who came down yesterday. You know, it was bad weather, and it's a work day, but a number of people, so many people made it down there. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah,
it was
full church, and a lot of people who we don't know in person, but who are loyal listeners of the show, who made the trek over to Edmetta, and it is appreciated.
And Teresa, his partner, very much appreciated, as did his brother Chris.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. Property Pulse, the industry insider's view of the real estate market
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Right, we are starting off talking retail trends on the Property Pulse. We are joined by Lynette Abad, the Director of Data and Research at Property Finder, and Mario Volpe, Sales and Leasing Manager at Engel and Volkers. Guys, it's great to have you both in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And we've got a nice survey to get our teeth into from the petrol delivery people, CAFU, about what drives tenants crazy while renting in Dubai. So it's a story of agents and it's a story of checks. Let's actually start off with the money. Let's start off with the checks. And one of the things that the survey found was that people are willing to pay slightly higher rents, 5% more, if they're allowed to pay in 12 checks. What are we actually seeing payment-wise at the moment?
Well, if I could maybe start as an agent, the norm is very much sort of 4 checks, creeping to 6. We have actually seen quite a few 12-check payments, because right now the landlords are obviously wishing to fill their properties. So they're coming up with nice ideas, and one of which is a multiple check system. Now, until RERA or Land Department actually come up with sort of a deposit scheme and also a payment scheme, you know, we are very much at the mercy of whatever a landlord wants to do. But, you know, we get paid monthly, and a 12-check payment system is very much the norm. It's the norm across the other side of the world as well, across the continent. So this is something that I think we'll see much, much more of.
Agree, 100%. If I were a renter, I definitely would select the 12 checks and pay a higher amount.
Do they still need to pay that 5% extra, though? I mean, are we at the point that it is a renter's market, to the point that 12 checks, same rent?
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, you don't need to pay more money. But of course, you've got to remember that Dubai has done things in a certain way for a long period, mm-hmm. and it's quite difficult to change that habit. And so, you know, one way to convince the landlord is, look, we can get you a little bit more money, but if you're flexible on the actual payments. The problem is also is landlords have also been let down by tenants, in that, you know, checks do bounce. And now with the law changing, it's quite difficult to actually get retribution or get some sort of compensation if the check bounces.
Look, I'm not a check fan anyway, because inevitably, once I've written out a check for the DWA deposit and a check for the Ajari and the checks for the rent, my handwriting's gone a bit funny, and there's at least one check every year that gets returned by the bank, and then I get fined. What's it going to take for us to get away from checks altogether, to move to a direct debit or credit card-based system?
Well, there are quite a few developers, especially the large ones like DP, for example, who have the 12-check system for their properties on rental, and they have an automatic debit solution with, I believe it's Emirates NBD. So this is coming, absolutely, and it's going to be an inevitable where the 12-check system I see coming in probably by mid-next year for a majority of the properties, just because of the amount of supply that's coming on online.
Yeah, for sure. They have to do something. I mean, the supply at the moment is very high. The demand is still very much there, but people are obviously looking to upgrade, either not just in areas from a commute point of view, So any landlord that wants to fill his property has to obviously offer these kind of incentives.
There was also quite a lot that came out of the survey about the quality of agents. Two-thirds of people saying that the properties they viewed didn't match their expectations. A lot of people struggling to coordinate timings with agents, to even communicate with agents. Did that surprise you in the survey?
From my point of view, no. And the reason I say no is, and it saddens me to say, I think the quality of agents leaves a lot to be desired. And we have too many agents. I think it's, despite the fact that you've got to have an exam and you've got to pass these exams to actually become a qualified broker, I think there's a lot of lost in translation in terms of language and also in terms of education. So it's not hard to be a broker, but it's very hard to be a good broker. And I think, unfortunately, we don't have enough of them, which is why I say to most people, move, obviously, whenever you have to, but take advice from recommendations. Now, even people that are recommended, you know, sometimes get it wrong. But when it comes to generally speaking, I think that the level of agents that we have, there are too many below the line.
Yeah, look, I would agree with that. I was swayed recently by some really pretty floorboards and I've ended up, and I'm choosing my words here very carefully, but dealing with someone who keeps reminding me of this very small amount of money he's made in the transaction and that he's done enough.
And you need to say that you didn't go through Engel and Volkers.
And I did not go through Engel and Volkers. I mean, when we talk about properties not matching expectations, I mean, this has been a big issue, hasn't it, with Lynette? And controls have been put in place for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to what Mario was saying about the education, I believe it's a week course now here with RERA.
Yes, three, four days.
Yeah. So this is something that we at Property Finder are actually looking into on how we can help our clients and enhance their education when it comes to ethics, when it comes to understanding how to properly deal with clients, the legal part of it. Because, yes, this definitely has to be addressed.
However, if I can say that there's also a disparity between the level of service that a tenant is expecting, especially one from Europe, where they are used to having perhaps a higher, slightly higher level of service. Here, the agent has actually done nothing wrong in terms of once the contract is signed on paper, that's where the agent's job ends. But the perception of the tenant is that, well, no, I paid you a commission and I now need you to help me here, 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 and here. And sometimes tenants go on literally for the whole year. So no disrespect to you there, Brandy, but, you know.
I moved into a flat where the doors didn't close, Mario.
Okay, you're right, Timon. Don't worry.
No shortage of questions coming in for you both. One has come in from an agent who says that they've worked here for 20 years. And whilst, you know, it's great to talk about the fact that in other parts of the world, people will take 12 rent checks or whatever it happens to be, they often also require references for tenants from previous landlords, maybe the bank, maybe other parties. Whereas here, we don't. It's a good point. Do we need a reference system for tenants coming in here?
I say 100% we do. And in fact, ironically, we did a rental in Jumeirah Islands fairly recently, and the owner was very particular about who the tenant was, where they worked, how long they'd been there, and wanting to know also about the family side of things, you know, how many children they had, how many, you know, relatives are going to come in. So that isn't quite obviously what we're talking. But interestingly, the agent that was dealing with it, every now and then was sort of throwing her hands up in the air, thinking, you know, that the landlord is being like oversensitive. And again, it's down to the fact that we never did it before and we don't do it. So mm-hmm. So to be asked to do it is like extra work. And do I really have to ask? And do I really have to show the payments? And do I really have to ask the bank statements, etc.? And my answer is definitely yes. I mean, I've been victim myself. Renting a property in England thinking that the person is a certain person and it turned out to be someone totally different and didn't pay the rent for 6 months. You know, and that has an impact on the individual landlord. And what I was saying before the break is also, you know, checks do bounce for tenants as well. So that's why there has to be some measured amount. It isn't always just on what the tenant wants. I mean, the law here is very much in favour of the tenant when you're talking about the rent committee, what have you. Not always, but, you know, they tend to favour the tenant. So to actually have some sort of a reference check, be it a bank reference check, a previous landlord's reference check. And of course, the land department can issue now, no objections, but like a clearance certificate. But that tells you whether I haven't been taken to court. That doesn't really go far enough. You know, it should tell me whether I'm a good tenant, not whether I've been to jail or whatever. Yeah. You know, that's so I think we're starting to think in the right way, but we're far away from where we need to be.
Another big sticky issue, and Dion has pointed it out, is who pays the commission. Mm. He's saying the landlord should pay the agency commission, which I have to say I'm also in that camp, because I feel that landlords would then do more to try and keep a tenant from year to year rather than the other way around. Anyone else?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And actually, I was having this conversation with the land department this week, actually. There's two things that I strongly believe that we need in this market. Number one is exclusivity. And number two is where the landlord and the seller pays the commission, because then they are vested in the transaction. However, it's very culturally, it's going to be very hard for that to be accepted here. But I do think that if that is implemented, we will clean up a lot of these issues that we're talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Obviously, in Europe and in the UK, it is the landlord and the seller that actually pays. And this was a question that was put to me on Monday. And yes, culturally, we've always had the buyer pay here. And I want to point out as well, as I did then, it isn't illegal for an agent to charge a buyer and a seller, or a landlord and or a tenant, as long as all parties are aware of it. So, you know, that's where perhaps some shady practices come in, that parties may not be aware of it. But if they are aware, it's not illegal. So I don't want people to think that agents are double dipping.
Okay. Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. And I say unfortunately because the messages keep coming. Lynette Abad, Director of Data and Research at Property Finder, and Mario Volpi, Sales and Leasing Manager at Engel & Völkers. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The movers and shakers shaping your world.
Well, my newsmaker is officially the world's newsmaker because she has just been judged the Time Person of the Year. And I am speaking, of course, about one Greta Thunberg, who has taken that honour every year. And I say honour, but Time itself has pointed out in the past that it isn't necessarily sort of the best person in the world as it is. It is the biggest newsmaker in the world for that year.
She's been extraordinary, hasn't she? But I never thought she'd get Time Person of the Year, because every 3 or 4 years it's a US president, isn't it? Or it's Vladimir Putin. It's someone of that scale, typically. So for her to, at the age of 15, she still is, I think, is phenomenal.
Yeah, you're right. It was Donald Trump in 2016 after he won the election. 2017, it was what they called the silence breakers, basically the women who sparked off the Me Too movement. This year, a lot of people thought that the Hong Kong protesters would get it for similar reasons. But Greta is on the cover. And yesterday, she was in Madrid, speaking at a big UN climate change conference, she started off her speech by talking about something that is close to your heart, and that is the importance of getting your message across effectively.
A year and a half ago, I didn't speak to anyone unless I really had to. But then I found a reason to speak. Since then, I've given many speeches and learned that when you're talking public, you should start with something personal or emotional to get everyone's attention. Say things like, "Our house is on fire, I want you to panic," or "How dare you?" But today I will not do that. because then those phrases are all that people focus on. They don't remember the facts, the very reason why I say those things in the first place.
She did go on to list a number of facts, evidence that the climate change issue is becoming more and more problematic. However, she did still give what I think of as a very clever soundbite that is certainly being picked up in all the headlines this morning.
I still believe that the biggest danger is not inaction. The real danger is when politicians and CEOs are making it look like real action is happening when, in fact, almost nothing is being done apart from clever accounting and creative PR.
I'm basically calling countries out for loopholes, for carbon credits and the rest of it. Greta, making the Time Person of the Year, comes on the same day as Dubai was chosen to host an inaugural climate change conference. We are going to be hosting the first ever MENA Climate Change Week 2020. It's going to coincide with Dubai Expo. The UN announced that yesterday in Madrid. So my question this morning is, does that mean that next year we are going to get Greta here on a boat?
That would be interesting. Through the Suez Canal, round Yemen, up past Muscat and into the Arabian Gulf.
I imagine that the officials holding the MENA Climate Change Week will do everything they can to make that happen.
She's an extraordinary person.
She is indeed. Well deserved. While we are looking this morning at newsmakers, no shortage of them today. And today, of course, the UK goes to the polls.
Yes, I've got three economic newsmakers for the price of one. I'm like a boy in a sweet shop at the moment. Fed interest rate meeting last night. UK election today. You've got Christine Lagarde making her debut as European Central Bank chief today. We're all forgetting that on Sunday there's a massive deadline in terms of the trade war and Donald Trump's tariffs on China, let alone the local economic stories. I mean, on any other day, a UAE GDP forecast from the Ministry of Economy would be a top story. But it's just raining economic stories today. But let's start with the story that's already broken. It broke last night in Washington, and it was the fact that the United States is keeping interest rates on hold. And of course, we care passionately about this because our currency is pegged to the US dollar. So whatever they do, we do. This is Jerome Powell. He's the head of the Fed chairperson, explaining their decision.
My colleagues and I decided to leave our policy rate unchanged after lowering it a total of 0.75 percentage point at the previous three meetings. As always, we base our decisions on judgment of how best to achieve the goals Congress has given us, maximum employment and price stability.
And the economists I was speaking to last night at a private banking event broadly agree with Jerome Powell and what he's done. Stefan Gerlach, I was talking to, who was formerly a policymaker on the Bank of Ireland, so has been in these meetings. He says the Fed have kind of got it right. Of course, Donald Trump disagrees. He thinks that interest rates in the United States should be at least 1% lower. He thinks there's a complete lack of vision, he calls it, from Jerome Powell. But cool-headed economists that I've been speaking to think the US has kind of got it about right with those interest rates. The biggie we're looking forward to today is, of course, the UK election. It does affect sterling. That does have an impact on the dirham and particularly the hospitality industry here in the UAE. So we'll be focusing on that.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down.
London calling because it is the UK election today. Yesterday, I met with the chief investment officer of the Swiss private bank EFG, who was in Dubai, Moz Afzal. I sat down with him to talk about a range of issues. Later on, he talks about the Saudi Aramco IPO. But we began with the election in the UK, and he says the likely election of Boris Johnson and the rise of other populist candidates, Bradley Scott.
I'm so sorry, but I have to interrupt with the vital question of the election this morning.
Which is?
Can you take a selfie in a voting booth?
And the answer is?
I'll find out for you.
Moz Afzal will not answer that question. But he does say that the rise of populist politicians like Boris Johnson in the United Kingdom, like Donald Trump in the United States and elsewhere, is part of a much more long-term trend, as he explains.
So the logic is actually quite straightforward. If you take the minimum wage in countries around the world, you'll notice that in real terms, minimum wage has dropped in real terms for about 50 years. The key trend driving that is globalization, the key trends are automation and technology, etc., etc. So all the things we actually know. So those minimum wage earners have been marginalised over that 50-year period. Now, they also have a single vote, as does someone very wealthy. So the populism that's been driven by this, by these, call it secular forces, are now kind of hit a crescendo, if you like. And so all of these threads we've seen in Chile, UK through Brexit, Trump through his election, and obviously Hong Kong, the common thread is that that marginal individual's been is hurting. So the pressure then is, how do we actually get them up? And that means increasing minimum wages across, I would say, most economies. That also means margins get squeezed for some of those companies. And so that is probably going to be the trend for the next few years, particularly if populism continues to rise. So margins get squeezed, not necessarily great for stock markets over the long term.
You're expecting a Boris Johnson victory tomorrow. We could get a Corbyn victory. He is a left, very, very left-wing would-be prime minister. In the United States, we have Elizabeth Warren. Again, a very, very left-wing would-be president of the United States. But you say regardless of that, we are going to see pressure on the big technology companies to pay more tax. And you say this is one of the big themes that you're looking at as chief investment officer.
So essentially, if you take big tech, and Amazon, for example, or Facebook, these companies have been, and Google, these companies have been very good at sheltering their earnings, if you like, from the tax man.
And you gave me a staggering stat earlier about Amazon versus Walmart.
Yeah, so we've looked at the tax that Walmart has paid over the last 20 years. Cumulatively has been around $60 billion. Amazon has paid $3 billion. Now, they've not paid tax legitimately because it's bottom line. Amazon doesn't make earnings because they reinvest all of their profits back into the business. So there's never a taxable event that's created. The way to tackle it, and we've seen this in France with Macron's digital tax, the UK's actually been a leader in digital taxes as well. I think what we'll do is move forward is that companies will then have to pay at the revenue level rather than at the profit level in terms of a tax. And the digital tax addresses that.
Again, for the investors in the room here, your clients who you're advising, what does that mean for them? Do we buy Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, the FANG stocks? Do we ditch them? What do we do?
So this is the kind of the very interesting point that I would like to make, is that over the last 15 to 20 years, there's been this big move to passive.
But by passive, you say passive investment funds, tracker funds, that kind of thing.
Correct. Those investment funds have gradually taken more and more market share from the active guys who typically own mid-cap and small-cap companies. So if you like, all of the invested capital keeps on going to the same big FANG stocks. And that, if you like, has been, you know, gradually increasing the market cap of these companies. So we think going forward, actually, the mid and smaller companies are the beneficiaries of, if you like, more tax on the bigger guys and more problems for the bigger guys, because those investors will probably flip back to mid and small cap. So for us, you know, how to play for the next couple of years is actually smaller mid caps. They've generally underperformed, certainly over the last 12 to 18 months.
You say one of the areas you like at the moment is emerging markets and emerging markets stocks. Why is that?
So essentially what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years is that emerging market companies, corporates in particular, have been deleveraging because of basically the stronger dollar, higher US rates, higher local rates, higher inflation. So that has been unwinding over the course of the last 12 months, where we've seen multiple rate cuts in countries like India, Indonesia, Brazil. And that is now starting to come through into their economies. So we'll start to see that picking up in 2020 and beyond as those low rates and better economic prospects start to hit their economies. So we think that cyclical adjustment is quite interesting for both debt and equity.
Well, let's talk about a couple of local emerging markets. We're here in the UAE, but Saudi Arabia is the big story. We've got Aramco, the world's biggest company now, almost $2 trillion as we stand here. But your thoughts on that?
For international investors, the fact that it's a local listing obviously lessens the appeal, although I'm sure that the investment banks will create tracker stocks and various other things to allow liquidity for the international investor. So I would say from an international investor perspective, it's slightly, you know, uninvestable for the time being. That will address itself over time. But I have two thoughts on this. First, if you want to own an energy company, it's probably the one you want to own. It's got the lowest cost structure. The second kind of key theme is that, you know, we have structural forces, you know, electric vehicles, electric cars. You've got to wonder whether, you know, we've hit the hump in terms of, you know, energy usage. And actually we have this sort of gradual, you know, decline of the energy complex, as well as technology through shale. So I think that the timeliness of this is quite interesting to me in terms of why now, given where we are in terms of the economic cycle. And the bottom line is, if you've got to own one, it probably is Aramco.
That's Moz Afzal, Chief Investment Officer at the Swiss private bank EFG, speaking to me last night.
Thanks for listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast and for being with us all this week. We're back Sunday morning at 6.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.